begin right now giving a rundown of the articles that I'm going to be covering in tonight's program. We're going to begin by taking a look at Mohamed Salameh, the individual who has been tabbed along with a colleague as the culprit or one of the culprits in the World Trade Center bombing. We're going to take a look at some interesting things vis-a-vis his situation. In particular, we're going to take a look at some leaks which law enforcement officials in New York have been very bitter about and which, at least according to those law enforcement officials, have compromised the investigation. We're also going to take a look at the strange circumstances of Mohamed Salameh's arrest. I've dubbed him, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, Lee Harvey Salameh, not the world's slickest terrorist, although he may have been a deliberate patsy, perhaps even a mind control job. But it is interesting the way he waltzed right in there to get his deposit on that rental van with nitrates all over his fingers. Not the world's most skilled terrorist, if in fact he is a terrorist at all. But we're going to be taking a look at his situation and his entry into the United States illegally and some of the things that have stemmed from the fact that he apparently is an illegal alien. We're also going to take a look at, among other things, the individual who has played a key role in the investigation of this incident, an individual who has in the past helped to investigate the bombing of the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, Lebanon, and Pan Am Flight 103. Both bombings, both terrorist incidents, the U.S. had advanced warning of, and they did nothing about it. And in fact, some months back, we took a look at an article about a fellow named Hoshaini, who apparently has been, at least according to an article in the Australian press, has been working with U.S. intelligence for quite some time and maintains, rightly or wrongly, that he was the individual who was deeply involved in the hostage-taking in Iran and was involved in the Marine Corps barracks bombing and Pan Am 103. It remains to be determined how accurate Hoshaimi's statements are, but whether or not his statements are accurate, certainly the behavior of the U.S. vis-a-vis the Beirut bombing, Pan Am 103, and now the World Trade Center bombing are curious and raise more questions than they answer. We're going to take a look at an article talking about how this incident has given the United States, given the world at large, or given, has brought to light, has shed light perhaps, given us an opportunity to view the U.S.'s counterterrorism program in action. And in fact, interestingly enough, one person involved in it, referred to this as the World Trade Center bombing investigation as the biggest thing since the Kennedy assassination, of all things. We will take a look at that during the course of the broadcast this evening. Once again, we're going to touch on the fact that Mohamed Salameh entered the country on an illegal visa back in 1988, and in a miscellaneous archive show, which I hope to extract or excerpt next week, we talked about some potential terrorist incidents in 1988 when Salameh entered the country, in fact, in the spring of 88, and some curious people, people from Islamic countries, Middle Eastern countries in New Jersey and elsewhere who were getting ready to, at least according to the authorities, stage terrorist incidents. And one of the questions that I have concerning the World Trade Center bombing is whether perhaps Mohamed Salameh may be connected to some of those individuals. Not a statement I'm making, but rather a question I'm asking. But I think it's a question worth asking, and it's a question worth attempting to get an answer to. We're also going to take a look at the money trail, or at least what we have been told is the money trail in the World Trade Center bombing. The money, which apparently helped to finance both Mohamed Salameh and Nidal Ayad's activities, comes from, surprise, surprise, Germany. And we're going to reflect on that. We're going to reflect on the fascist third position, a manifestation of fascism in which German and European and American fascists have embraced, among other things, many Islamic fundamentalists and Islamic terrorists, as well as ultra-left-wing terrorists, in an attempt to not only win over certain elements of the left-wing and more progressive forces, but also to fulfill the old fascist agenda of eliminating democracy. And indeed, I think the fascist third position is something that we should be reflecting on very carefully as we take a look at the World Trade Center bombing and the things that are going on these days. Interestingly enough, not only the World Trade Center bombing, but also the shooting at CIA headquarters earlier this year, which has been blamed on a Pakistani national who illegally entered the United States, that has brought a call in the United States for a tightening of U.S. immigration procedures, a call which is not altogether unlike some of the things that we're seeing in Germany today. In Germany, the Führer, no pun intended, the Führer over immigrants in Germany has fueled the political fortunes of the far right, and Nazism, to the surprise of many, but not yours truly, is once again on the rise in Germany, and we're going to be taking a look at events in Germany which echo some of the calls we're seeing in the United States, or perhaps it's the other way around. Anyway, calls are being sounded in the United States to tighten immigration procedures so that we don't have these terrorist aliens coming into the United States, in Germany, the far right, explicitly Nazi elements, are making political hay by calling for the expulsion of immigrants and the tightening of immigration laws. What's going on in Germany and what appears to be going on in the United States might be viewed as six of one and half a dozen of the other. Also, by the way, in connection with that, we're going to review a very short section of an article that we read into the archives some weeks back. This is an article from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 33, by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. And we're going to review a section of Scott's article on the Task Force on Combating Terrorism. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the martial law contingency plans, and specifically an aspect of them that calls for the rounding up and deportation of, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote, and, quote, terrorist aliens, unquote, are something that we are hearing quite a bit about these days. I suspect, it remains to be determined, but I suspect that the money trail coming from Germany, in addition to pointing toward international terrorists as the culprit in the World Trade Center bombing, this may very well, it remains to be seen, but it may very well further fuel the outrage in Germany or the popular calls for the limitation of immigration and perhaps even for the expulsion of certain immigrants. We're going to be taking a look at the CIA headquarters shooting. We're going to take a look at a worldwide manhunt for the suspect. We are told that the suspect is a Pakistani national. I don't know how accurate those claims are, but we're going to reflect on the shooting at CIA headquarters. And interestingly enough, the suspect that has been named in the media worked for the son of Victor Marchetti, a quote ex unquote CIA agent who has been quite critical of the CIA. I don't know what one can make of this, but among the possibilities I hold open is that perhaps, and this is only a possibility, again, a question I'm asking, not a statement I'm making, but perhaps this is an attempt to discredit the CIA's critics. The assassination of CIA station chief in Greece, Welch, in the mid-1970s, specifically in 1975, was used by the agency to attack, among others, Philip Agee and the Church Committee and other critics of the CIA, who, according to the CIA, were responsible for the assassination of Richard Welch. Once again, CIA station chief in Greece. As it turns out, his assassination had nothing whatsoever to do with the critics of the CIA, be it Philip Agee or the Church Committee, but it was used in that particular regard by the CIA, and I think that in light of that, we need to evaluate the employment of the CIA headquarters shooting suspect by Chris Marchetti in that particular context. One of the most outrageous things that I can recall seeing in the news in a long time, and I've seen a lot of outrageous things in the news. I wasn't exactly thrilled by George Bush's pardoning of some of his fellow criminals in the Iran-Contra scandal, although that was to be expected. But the misdeeds of the U.S. intelligence community so often lead to provisions which allow for even greater misdeeds. Just such a situation appears to be developing vis-a-vis the BNL scandal, one aspect of the Iraqgate scandal. The CIA, we are told, fumbled the ball vis-a-vis the investigation of the BNL scandal. I think, if so, I think that may have been a deliberate fumble. But in any event, the alleged fumbling by the CIA vis-a-vis the BNL scandal has led to a call for a wider domestic law enforcement role for the CIA. And already a number of people have noted with considerable alarm that this could permit even greater domestic surveillance by the CIA, even greater involvement by the Central Intelligence Agency in the monitoring of American citizens, something which nominally at least is illegal. Note the use of the term nominally, because in fact it is altogether commonplace. But this is something which really is, to my way of thinking, about as grotesque as anything I've ever seen, where misdeeds by the intelligence community, in this case the CIA, are being used as a pretext for setting up a provision which almost certainly will allow even greater and more flagrant misdeeds. One of the things that we reflected on last week, or that we explored last week, was the collaboration between the dominant elements of our national security establishment, intelligence community in particular, and the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Iran. Last week, we visited with Farah Mansour and had a truly historic broadcast in which Farah disclosed for the first time the research that he has done revealing that Iran's nuclear capability, which is being cited now by the intelligence community as a possible justification for a move against Iran. We viewed how the nuclear capability that the Iranians have, such as it is, actually came not only from the United States, but specifically came from elements of our intelligence community that we later viewed in the Iran-Contra scandal, notably the intelligence milieu around Albert Hakim, one of the players in the Iran-Contra scandal. There has been considerable discussion since the evil empire evaporated about just what exactly the U.S. military was going to be doing in the post-Cold War period. And indeed, as the layoffs in the defense industry mount, not as fast as some people would like, but they are mounting, and as the military, this enormously powerful military structure that we have, goes casting about for a new post-Cold War role, one of the problems that has been cited is just what enemy could possibly justify a continuation of the enormous levels of spending, both on the military proper and the intelligence community that we saw during the Cold War. One of the things that I hold open, and one of the things that I think we need to very seriously examine, is that perhaps the very Islamic fundamentalist movement, elements of which have collaborated with U.S. intelligence in the past, notably in the October surprise and the Iran-Contra scandal, we may very well be finding the Islamic fundamentalist movement as the new evil empire. Certainly there has been an upsurge in terrorism, which either directly or indirectly has been attributed to Islamic fundamentalism, and in addition to perhaps serving as a pretext for a crackdown on civil liberties and a broadening of police and surveillance powers in the United States, if the Islamic fundamentalists or elements thereof either continue to generate some of the incidents that they are alleged to have generated or did generate, we may very well find that the Islamic fundamentalist movement is the target for the post-Cold War American military. Certainly, I think that's a possibility that has to be seriously considered, particularly in light of some of the things that have been happening in the news in recent weeks. On Saturday, the papers featured news of an incident which happened 2 weeks after the World Trade Center bomb went off. One of the things that we should note about the World Trade Center bombing is that it helped to throw into confusion the U.S. capital market, specifically the commodities market. The commodities exchange was housed in the New York branch of it was housed in the World Trade Center. And the World Trade Center bombing, among other things, threw considerable confusion into the U.S. investment community, and the World Trade Center was, in certain respects at least, an element of the financial nerve center of the United States. On a Friday, this past Friday, the financial nerve center of India was the target of bombs, which are suspected to have been set off by Islamic fundamentalists. Specifically, some 13 bombs, killing some 200 people and injuring over 1,000, went off in Bombay, a cruel coincidence. Perhaps Herb Cain will have a lot of fun with that in his Name Freak column. But the bombs in Bombay, I think, are something that we should be taking a look at as we're seeing allegations concerning a Pakistani national having shot up some people in front of the CIA headquarters, as we are seeing the World Trade Center bombing being blamed rightly or wrongly on Islamic fundamentalists, and as we are seeing Islamic fundamentalist activity broadening around the world, some of it of a terrorist nature, such as some of the things that have been going on in Egypt. I think we should be looking very carefully at these things, and among the questions that we should be asking is whether perhaps some of these incidents are being egged on or actively aided by elements of our own national security establishment, because in the past, it is a matter of record that elements of our national security establishment in particular, some of those fascist elements grouped around Ronald Reagan, George Bush, some of the elements we viewed in the Iran-Contra scandal, some of the elements grouped around the milieu of Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple, the quote X, unquote, CIA agents who were involved in arming and training the terrorist cadres of, among others, Muammar Gaddafi, the Italian Red Brigades, elements of the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Japanese Red Army faction. All of those we are opposed to, at least nominally, and yet we find elements of the intelligence community working and actively training those very elements. And again, this goes right to the core of the focus of Radio Free America 38, as well as numerous other archive shows that I've done. It is a matter of record, although unfortunately a not very well recognized record, that elements of our intelligence community have actively aided and abetted some of the very terrorists we are told we need to protect ourselves against. And among the strategic goals of that assistance and that cooperation are the setting up of provocations, not only to justify the institution of police state tactics at home, but to justify military aggression abroad. And we'll be exploring that at greater length this evening. In the past week, too, there was a crackdown on Islamic fundamentalists in Egypt. And in fact, the two suspects that have been arrested so far in the World Trade Center bombing are the followers of a fellow named Omar Abdul Rahman, who stood trial and was acquitted vis-a-vis the assassination of Anwar Sadat in Egypt. And by the way, we're going to be talking about the assassination of Anwar Sadat. We're going to be talking about William Buckley, the former CIA station chief in Lebanon, who was involved with training Anwar Sadat's bodyguards, and we're going to be kicking around some of the things that have come to light in the news, and we're going to be seeing that against the background of the things that have been developing over the past decade or two vis-a-vis international terrorism and the involvement of certain dominant elements of our national security establishment in that terrorism. We are also going to be taking a look at an article from the San Jose Mercury News talking about the reason, or at least according to the Mercury columnists, reasons, actually not a Mercury columnist, but a guest columnist, a fellow named Mark Juergensmeyer, who is a dean of the University of Hawaii School of Hawaiian, Asian, and Pacific Studies. But we're going to take a look at a little bit of the history of Islamic fundamentalism and why Islamic fundamentalists, at least according to this individual, hate the United States. And interestingly, it goes back to activities in Egypt in the 1950s. Recall that in Radio Free America number 3 and again in Radio Free America number 22, we discussed how Egypt in the 1950s was the site for one of the more important and little recognized U.S. intelligence operations. By the way, we also talked about this in an archive show about the fascist third position, a miscellaneous archive show. We took a look at a CIA operation in which elements of the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that we took in at the end of World War II, many of them SS and Gestapo veterans, many of them heinous war criminals, were sent to Egypt to train and set up not only the Egyptian General Staff, but the Egyptian Intelligence Service, and it was while SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, the Third Reich Commando Extraordinaire and a Galen and CIA operative, while Skorzeny was leading this contingent, he helped to set up the very first Palestinian terrorist groups. This, in many ways, set the pattern for cooperation between some elements of our intelligence system and the very terrorists that we are told we need to work against. We're going to review an article that we covered a few weeks back, namely another apparent terrorist incident that was staged by Islamic fundamentalists, namely the car bomb assassination of Uğur Mumcu, the top Turkish expert on terrorism. And it was Uğur Mumcu who did much of the work exposing the strong connections between the Central Intelligence Agency and elements of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the Turkish National Action Party, a fascist political party with strong links to the United States. The most notorious member of that, of course, was Mehmet Ali Aja, who shot the Pope in 1981. We're told that the KGB was running him. That is a ludicrous conclusion. At this point, it is just about every place except for the United States. It is completely discredited. But the Pope shooting is one of the things that Uğur Mumcu had a lot to say about, and it'll be interesting to see what develops now that Uğur Mumcu is out of the way. We're going to take a look at a column from the New York Times in which there is speculation that the World Trade Center bombing may very well key future terrorist incidents in the United States, and that those terrorist incidents may very well lead to a tightening of security procedures and police and surveillance tactics here in the United States. That is one of the things that I have been speculating about, and apparently I am not alone. Another column in the same vein was carried in the San Jose Mercury News on Wednesday, March 3rd, this by a fellow named Alan Lupo, and he entitles his column, "Will We Give Up Our Freedom When the Lights Go Out?" I don't know, but we're going to take a look at this column, too, and he talks about how Americans are not yet used to the sight of gun-carrying guards in the streets as a commonplace occurrence. And if things keep happening like the World Trade Center bombing or the situation we have in Texas, the very things that Alan Lupo says we may see ourselves seeing, we will be seeing. I have a lot of questions about the Branch Davidians in the current standoff in Texas. Mr. Vernon Howell, a.k.a. David Koresh, or Koresh, the wacko from Waco, appears to be a relatively well-connected individual. There is much investigation yet to be done about Mr. Koresh and where he got all of his money and his assets. But this cult is in many ways reminiscent of Jonestown, which, of course, as we've looked at in various Radio Free America shows, including programs number 7 and 8, there are very firm indications at this point that Jonestown was a U.S. intelligence operation. There are aspects of the Branch Davidian cult in Texas that are reminiscent not only of Jonestown, but also of the Manson organization. And we're going to be speculating about the wacko from Waco, the standoff in Texas, which may be connected to what is going on or what has gone on in New York. Once again, that's not a statement I'm making. It's a question I'm asking. But there are, I think, some very serious questions to be asked about just what exactly is going on in Texas. Speaking of Texas, we're going to be taking a look at Mr. Koresh's, a.k.a. Howell's, calls for war. He has boasted that he can blow a Bradley fighting vehicle up, and as a result now they replace the Bradley fighting vehicles, the authorities have, with M1 Abrams tanks. And so we are now treated to the sight of tanks being used for domestic law enforcement, a rather significant escalation, in my opinion. Also, an odd aspect of the standoff in Texas came to light in the news the past week. The Branch Davidians were playing loud rock music, blasting loud rock music, at least according to the journalistic accounts, in order to unnerve the federal agents who were laying siege to their compound. That reminded me of the situation in Panama a few years back when Manuel Noriega was holed up in the Vatican embassy to Panama. The U.S. attempted to smoke him out by blasting loud rock music at him. Well, as they used to say in the 60s, the war has come home, and now we're seeing something oddly reminiscent of that, only not in Panama anymore, right here in the United States. We're going to take a look, too, at charges that have surfaced in the wake of the situation in Waco, so to speak, that the raid on the compound, on the Branch Davidian compound, was compromised by, among other things, a tip-off by party or parties unknown. We're going to take a look at that and ruminate about that a bit. And the last thing we're going to look at tonight, assuming we have time, and as I go through the articles, I'm inclined to doubt that we're going to have time for phone-ins, but we'll see. The last item we're going to take a look at this evening is a call by, of all people, Charlie Beckwith, retired Colonel Charlie Beckwith, who led the Desert One rescue mission to pull the U.S. hostages, ostensibly to pull the U.S. hostages out of Iran. Charlie Beckwith is now calling for a federal investigation about the botched raid on the cult in Waco. And one wonders, it's interesting to see old Charlie Beckwith emerging on the scene again. He has been very critical of the way the raid was conducted. Many people have been just as critical about the way that his raid in Iran was conducted, and there have even been some indications that perhaps that raid was deliberately compromised. Among the people involved with that, by the way, were Richard Secord and Air Force Colonel John Dutton, both of them later key players in the Iran-Contra scandal. Certainly individuals who can be viewed as having divided loyalties vis-a-vis helping to save Jimmy Carter's political fortunes. That's what we have on tap for this evening. I'm going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. It's time now for the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program. Let's pop a few more peas. Why don't we? There we go. All righty. We're going to begin by taking a look at the events that have been happening the last several... We're not going to begin. That's what we're going to do. We're going to take a look at the events that have transpired over the past several weeks. In particular, we are laying down this particular prepared portion of tonight's program as yet another installment of Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3. Actually, in terms of what I have been doing with One Step Beyond and the various archive shows, this probably should be entitled The Terra Connection Part 390-something, or somewhere thereabouts. One of the main themes of One Step Beyond and the archive shows for, lo, these 14 years now, has been the active collaboration between elements of our intelligence community and national security establishment and some of the very international terrorists that we are told we need to protect ourselves against. There are a variety of motives for this at various different strategic levels. Bear in mind, during the course of the discussion this evening, that when our national security establishment decides to move in any given direction, they do so when to move in that direction will scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. Bear in mind also that our national security establishment is not a monolith. There are elements of the national security establishment that are certainly opposed to some of the things that we have been seeing in recent weeks, and yet there are also some, and unfortunately they are the dominant elements, that have been actively involved and are deeply complicit with some of these very terrorist incidents. I will note that due to the large volume of material that we have to go through this evening, that the ancillary discussion is going to be very fast-paced, and there is no way in the world that I'm going to be able to go into all of the references in any detail that are necessary as foundation, so to speak, for the discussion. Let me cite some of the archive shows that, in fact, let me cite the archive shows that listeners should be referring to for some of the relevant documentation. First of all, Radio Free America program number 4, dealing with Turpel Wilson and Company. Radio Free America program number 19, number 20, number 21, 22, 23. Radio Free America program number 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, and miscellaneous archive shows about the fascist third position and the Gander crash, the December surprise 85, as well as the other installments, and there have been quite a few of them, of Radio Free America program number 38. All of those broadcasts document the active collaboration between significant elements, the dominant elements of our national security establishment, and once again some of the very terrorists that we are told we need to protect ourselves against. It is against that background, that we're going to be looking at some of the events, in particular the World Trade Center bombing and some of the similar incidents that have been occurring around the world. I would note with the World Trade Center bombing, and I'm not going to go into the clippings here, I have them recently moved and I have them packed away in a box, but on Saturday, February 27th, and the following day, the 2 days after the bomb went off in the World Trade Center, I would note that the bomb was being described as having been composed of plastic explosive. That has since changed. I do not know how accurate those first accounts were. I do not know whether the changes in the journalistic accounts, as is sometimes the case, represent a cover-up. That's a possibility I hold open, although not a statement I'm by any means making. I also would note that the initial attribution for the blast was laid at the doorstep of Balkan extremists. Some 57 different groups took credit at one point or another for the bombing, but I would note that in the very first accounts, and we may have time to go into this next week, in the very first accounts of the bombing, quote, Croatian extremists, unquote, were being blamed. Now, the reason for this was that according to a number of sources, and this was widely reported in the newspapers the first couple of days after the bombing, 15 minutes before the explosion, a Croatian extremist group took credit for the bombing and warned that there would be a bomb. When you warn about something ahead of time, that is indeed credible. Now, one of the things that we have looked at in various archive shows, notably Radio Free America program number 17, and in Radio Free America program number 36, the destabilization of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, we took a look at the Ustashi. The Ustashi were the brutal Croatian fascists who collaborated with Hitler during World War II, and like so many fascist and Third Reich alumni, they jumped to the U.S. intelligence system. Many elements of them did after World War II. They also, the Ustashi, that is, remained intact to a considerable extent, and the Ustashi became a key element of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and the World Anti-Communist League, and they have been deeply involved in a number of terrorist incidents in the Cold War period. When you see the phrase Croatian extremists, one should basically train oneself to say Ustashi. And if, in fact, as the newspapers initially reported, Croatian extremists took credit for the bombing 15 minutes ahead of time, that would indicate that perhaps the Islamic fundamentalists, Lee Harvey Salome, as I call this fellow, Mohammed Salome, and his collaborators, real or alleged, that perhaps they are not the real culprits. Or, if they were involved, perhaps they were part of a milieu which was connected to the fascist third position. Now, the fascist third position, to make a very long story very short, is an element of the fascist movement which incorporates and emulates Middle Eastern terrorism. The fascist third position aims at incorporating certain elements of the, or winning over certain elements of the extreme left as well as the progressive political movement to a fascist agenda. And among the idols, the role models of the fascist third position are Muammar Gaddafi, Ayatollah Khomeini, and Louis Farrakhan, and they have found cause with Islamic extremists. One of the common denominators, of course, is the doctrinaire anti-Semitism of the fascist third position. In addition, the fascist third position have made common cause with some of the extreme left-wing terrorists, whom the fascist third position people see as brothers or sisters in the struggle against, quote, bourgeois society, unquote. And when we see Croatian extremists, at least according to the initial accounts, having warned about the bomb 15 minutes ahead of time, and when we see now the attribution going toward Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, among the possibilities that has to be considered, and this is, again, by no means a statement I'm making, but rather a question that I'm asking, one of the things we have to consider is the possibility that elements of the fascist third position may be implicated here. Certainly one of the things that we've looked at in the past is the ongoing connection between elements of the fascist third position and elements of Western intelligence, U.S. intelligence in particular. There have been some curious aspects, a lot of curious aspects, actually, about the World Trade Center bombing. In the New York Times of Friday, March 5th, some of them were discussed. I'm going to read a couple of extracts now from an article by Robert McFadden of the New York Times, capital M-C, capital F-A-D-D-E-N. This is Dateline New York, March 4th. It's a New York Times story. It's headlined, New Jersey man is charged in bombing of Trade Center after rented van is traced. Subheads, luck cited in case, suspect tied to Islamic fundamentalist sect. Past is murky. And skipping down in the story, we find the arrest's timing brought on another bitter dispute. City law enforcement officials, bristling for days over what they called news leaks by federal officials, said a New York Newsday report today tracing the van to a rental agency in New York City had forced a premature arrest of a suspect who was being followed, dashing all hopes that he might lead them to other collaborators. There was no indication that the newspaper was asked to withhold the article. One of the possibilities I hold open is that perhaps some of the alleged bumbling was in fact a deliberate attempt to obscure some of the higher-ups in this particular situation. I suspect, I cannot prove, but I suspect that the World Trade Center bombing was a provocation, although the individuals involved at the operational level, as is so often the case, may very well have been sincere dupes, whether Islamic fundamentalist extremists or whether, as initially reported, Croatian extremists. Very often these incidents are generated by more powerful people who keep themselves hidden. Many of the provocations that elements of our intelligence system have been involved in fact, used at the operational level, sincere dupes of one persuasion or another. In Italy, for example, many of the Red Brigade's elements that participated in the Strategy of Tension, actively funded by the CIA, the Strategy of Tension was a programming of bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations, conducted by, at least ostensibly, the far left. This discredited the left in Italy completely, and it designed and did, in fact, drive the Italian political body rightward. And it should be noted, though, that many of the individuals who actually participated at the operational level were sincere dupes, but the strings were pulled from on high. We're going to talk more about the conflict between the New York City law enforcement officials and the federal officials. And again, note that at least according to New York City law enforcement officials, the leaks by the federal officials have compromised the investigation, forced premature arrest, or at least one premature arrest, and may have actually helped to obscure rather than illuminate and pursue the trail of the culprits in this event. There's another story in that very same article by the there's another article in this very same issue of the New York Times, I should say, Friday, March 5th of 1993. This is by Allison Mitchell of the New York Times, also Dateline New York, March 4th. Headline, suspect in bombing is linked to sect with a violent voice. It reads in part, Mohammed A. Salameh, S-A-L-A-M-E-H, the suspect arrested today in the bombing of the World Trade Center, is said by law enforcement officials to be a follower of a blind Muslim cleric who preaches a violent message of Islamic fundamentalism from a walk-up mosque in Jersey City. The Muslim cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who stood trial in Egypt a decade ago in the assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat, has emerged as the spiritual leader of a movement that the Egyptian government contends is behind dozens of violent attacks in Egypt, including a spate of shootings of foreign terrorists, of foreign tourists, excuse me. Interesting slip there, of foreign tourists. Skipping down well into the other article now, I'm going to jump to the article that was authored by Mr. McFadden, by Robert McFadden. More about the circumstances surrounding not only Mohammed Salameh, but also Sheikh Abdul Rahman. Skipping down in this article, Sheikh Abdul, and again, the headline on the front page of the New York Times of 3-5, New Jersey man is charged in bombing of Trade Center after rented van is traced. Subheaded, luck cited in case, suspect tied to Islamic fundamentalist sect, past is murky. And skipping down, we find Sheikh Abdul Rahman, an Egyptian Islamic fundamentalist minister who entered the United States illegally from the Sudan in 1991 and faces a deportation order, is widely regarded in Egypt as a spiritual leader of several radical groups that make up the Egyptian branch of Islamic Jihad or Islamic Holy War. The Sheikh, blind and in ill health, has been linked by investigators to the 1981 assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat of Egypt, but was acquitted of charges that he incited the assassination. His frequent presence at a Brooklyn mosque, Farouk Majid, was noted by investigators in the 1990 assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahane of the Militant Jewish Defense League because El-Said A.A. Nosser, who was acquitted of the killing, occasionally worshipped at the same mosque. I would note, although we're not going to go into it this evening, that as a result of this incident, the investigation of the assassination of Meir Kahane has been reopened. And again, we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but note that at least in the initial investigation, Sheikh Abdul Rahman was being linked to the assassination of Anwar Sadat. He was acquitted for lack of evidence. We're going to talk about the assassination of Anwar Sadat in just a couple of minutes, because there are indications that elements of U.S. intelligence may have been complicit in that as well. And in particular, the name William Buckley, the late CIA station chief in Lebanon, whose kidnapping by Islamic fundamentalists linked to Iran, his kidnapping was the rationalization, the ostensible rationale, I should say, for the weapons transfers to Iran. Skipping down in this article, authorities said the trail that led to Mr. Salameh's arrest began with a lucky break. The discovery in the rubble at the Trade Center last week of twisted fragments of metal that contained the serial number of what turned out to have been a yellow Model E350 Ford Econoline van. The number is stamped in various places on the van. Federal officials traced the serial number to its owner, the Ryder Truck Rental Company in Alabama, and discovered that the van bore the Alabama license plate XA70668. Further investigation revealed that the van had been most recently in the possession of a Ryder rental outlet at 1558 Kennedy Boulevard in Jersey City. At that agency, officials learned that Mr. Salameh had rented the van on February 23rd, putting $400 down as a deposit on a $200 week-long rental. It was unclear today what happened to the van in the next few days, but officials said they believed it was at ground zero, packed with hundreds of pounds of explosive on the day of the blast. 2 hours after the explosion, investigators said, Mr. Salameh went back to the rental agency and reported that the van had been stolen from a parking lot in Jersey City, where he said he had left it. Mr. Salameh, saying the theft was not his fault, asked that his deposit be returned. He was told he needed a police report, and he went away. On Monday, investigators said, he returned to the rental agency and asked again for the deposit. As evidence that he had rented the van, investigators said, Mr. Salome presented his original rental agreement. The papers, officials said, were later found to be flecked with nitrates, a chemical in the explosives whose traces had turned up in the debris of the devastated underground garage. But Mr. Salome still did not have a police report on the theft and was again turned away. On Wednesday, federal agents who had traced the van arrived at the rental agency, learned Mr. Salome's identity, and traced the location of the Kensington Avenue apartment through the telephone number he left. The number was in the name of Josie Hadas, H-A-D-A-S, officials said, but they declined to say who she was or whether she played any role in the case. The suspect was placed under surveillance by agents who had decided not to arrest him immediately in hopes that he might lead them to other suspects. But the surveillance did not last. A published report in New York Newsday today said federal agents had traced the van to the Jersey City Rental Agency. A published report in New York Newsday today said federal agents had traced the van to the Jersey City Rental Agency. Don Forrest, New York editor, New York City Rental Agency. Don Forrest, F-O-R-S-T, New York editor of Newsday, said tonight that the FBI and the city police knew by 6 p.m. Wednesday of the newspaper's plans to publish the article and offered no objections. He also said no complaints were received after the article appeared. But fearful that the suspect might flee, agents decided to abandon their surveillance and arrest him. He was lured back to the rental agency in a telephone call suggesting that he could now collect his refund. Well, if in fact Mohamed Salome was one of the culprits in the bombing, and I do not know if he was or wasn't, he does not appear to be the world's most skillful terrorist. One of the questions, among the possibilities I hold open, one is that he was in fact innocent and is being framed. Another is that he has in fact basically been thrown over. He's a patsy. Although involved at some low level, he was brought in and was not fully aware of what he was doing. Another possibility that has to be considered is that if he was involved in the bombing, that he may be under mind control. He certainly does not appear to be the world's shrewdest terrorist, if in fact he's a terrorist at all. I would note, too, that Mr. Salome, and we're going to look at this later, entered the United States in 1988 in a time period in which there were a number of indications of a possible wave of internationally based terrorism here in the United States. There is a miscellaneous archive show, another of the archive shows, by the way, dealing with U.S. complicity in international terrorism. One of the ones I did not mention earlier is called Election 88, and you can obtain that from Archives on Audio. We're going to take a look at some of the other circumstances surrounding Mr. Salome, and again note that one of the people who worships at this mosque is an Islamic fundamentalist minister who has been linked by investigators to a number of terrorist incidents and violent incidents abroad, and although he was acquitted, his name has been brought up in connection with the assassination of President Anwar al-Sadat. I do not know whether or not Mr. Sheikh Rahman was involved in the Sadat assassination, but there are indications that elements of U.S. intelligence may very well have been involved in that assassination. I would note that Mr. Sadat was flanked at the time, or President Sadat was flanked at the time of his assassination by his successor, Hosni Mubarak, and also a fellow named Ghazala, who became not only defense minister under Mubarak, but who also was a player in the Eatsco scandal with people like Richard Secord, Eric von Marbod, and some of the other operatives who of the Turple Wilson milieu, whose names later cropped up in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal in a big way. A couple of days before the assassination, George Bush was meeting with Hosni Mubarak, and one of the things that became a bellwether of assassination and violence in the 1980s was to watch where George Bush went. Basically, if George Bush traveled someplace, very frequently somebody died or there was a terrorist incident shortly afterward. And indeed, it was while George Bush was director of the Central Intelligence Agency that the Turple Wilson operation, which was involved in training many of the world's most notorious terrorists, that was launched. While George Bush was director of the CIA, and many of the people who figured not only in the Triple Wilson operations, but also in the Iran-Contra scandal, were very prominent in the CIA under George Bush and were associated with him, notably people like Theodore Shockley and Thomas Kleins.